A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's question this week is the kind of thing that only sounds like a joke until you start reading the actual product labels. He wants the 10 worst canned foods humans have ever invented. The stuff that might save you in a nuclear bunker, but which you might not even want to eat if it came to that. Not just the famous ones either. He wants the cursed, the ones where the gap between what the label promises and what slides out of the tin is measured in light years. And then he wants the honest answer to the question nobody asks until day 40 underground, which of these would actually keep you alive.
And the thing is, the question has real structure once you look at it, because canned food is this weird paradox. The technology was designed to preserve food, but what it actually does is cook food at high temperature and pressure inside a sealed metal cylinder and then leave it there for years. That isn't preservation. That's a slow-motion chemistry experiment with a best-before date.
A chemistry experiment that outlasts the desire to eat the result. So we went digging through the annals of food preservation, and let me tell you, humans have made some choices. Choices that suggest we were very hungry, very optimistic, or possibly just dared each other.
Canning starts with Nicholas Appert, 1809. Napoleon's government offered a prize for a food preservation method that would keep armies fed on campaign. Appert figured out that if you seal food in a glass jar and boil it, it keeps. He won the prize. He published the method. And here's the beautiful part. This was half a century before germ theory. Appert had no idea why it worked. He just knew that sealed plus heat equals food that doesn't kill you later.
Which is the entire history of canning in one sentence. We figured out it worked before we understood what we were killing. And once we had the method, we applied it to everything. Everything. Because the logic seems sound. If boiling a jar of peas preserves the peas, boiling a jar of anything preserves the anything.
And that's where the taxonomy of terrible canned food comes from. There are three distinct failure modes. One, foods that ferment or decompose in the can, creating pressure and foul compounds. Two, foods that are canned whole when they should never be. Three, foods that are processed so aggressively they become textureless abominations. Those are the three circles of this particular hell.
And the nuclear bunker angle matters because the USDA and FEMA both recommend canned goods as the backbone of emergency stockpiles. The reasoning is sound. Commercial canning sterilizes at 240 to 250 degrees Fahrenheit under pressure. That kills the botulism spores. The food is shelf-stable for years, sometimes decades. But there's a difference between survivable and palatable. And this episode lives in that gap.
So let's establish the ranking methodology, because Daniel asked for a proper countdown, not a vibe. We scored these on four axes. Sensory offense, which is smell, texture, appearance on opening. The gap between what the label promises and what emerges, whether it's actually a survival viable calorie source. And the day 40 test, which is, would you eat this on day 40 in the bunker when the alternative is nothing?
Day 40 is the right number. Day 1, you have hope. Day 10, you have hunger. Day 40 is when you're looking at a bulging tin of fermented fish and doing the math on whether starvation is the better option.
Let's begin the countdown, starting with the canned foods that are technically edible but raise serious questions about human judgment.
Position 10. Canned lutefisk. For anyone who hasn't had the pleasure, lutefisk is Scandinavian cod that's been soaked in lye. Actual lye. The same chemical used to unblot drains and dissolve bodies in certain crime dramas. The lye treatment breaks down the fish proteins into something that is, and I'm quoting the culinary literature here, gelatinous.
The traditional process is already alarming before the can gets involved. Dried cod, soaked in cold water for days, then soaked in a lye solution, then soaked again to wash the lye out. The fish swells, the proteins denature, and you end up with a translucent, jelly-like substance that technically still counts as fish. Now take that and pressure cook it in a sealed can at 240 degrees.
What emerges isn't fish. It's fish adjacent. The texture has been described as somewhere between firm jelly and a very apologetic custard. The flavor is mild, which is almost worse, because it means the only thing you're experiencing is the texture. A texture that no amount of butter and white sauce can fully redeem.
And yet, it's a real commercial product. You can buy canned lutefisk in Scandinavian specialty stores and online. It exists because the Norwegian and Swedish diaspora wanted their traditional holiday food, and canning was the only way to ship it. The canning process doesn't improve it. It takes an already texturally challenging food and applies industrial pressure and heat until the last remaining shred of fish integrity gives up.
Position 9. Canned haggis. The Scottish answer to the question, what do we do with the organs? Traditional haggis is sheep's heart, liver, and lungs, minced with onion, oatmeal, suet, and spices, then boiled in a sheep's stomach. It's actually, and I'll defend this, good when made properly, nutty, savory, peppery.
The canned version is a different animal, literally and figuratively. The sheep's stomach casing doesn't survive the canning process, so what you get is a loose, gray-brown paste of organ meat and oatmeal that's been retort-sterilized until the texture is uniform and slightly grainy. The flavor survives mostly, but the structure is gone. It's haggis that's given up.
The visual is the real problem. Haggis is supposed to look like a rustic, hearty sausage. Canned haggis looks like something you'd scoop out of a hoof. It slides out of the tin in one piece, holding the shape of the can, and then slumps.
There's an entire subgenre of canned food that's just this. Food that was designed to have structure. And the canning process has removed the structure, leaving only the memory of structure. Canned haggis is the definitive example. It's edible. It's even reasonably nutritious. But the gap between what haggis is and what canned haggis becomes is a canyon.
Position 8. Canned smoked oysters in oil. Now, before anyone gets defensive, smoked oysters in a tin aren't inherently terrible. They're a pantry staple. They go on crackers. They have a certain mid-century cocktail party charm.
But the pressure processing does something specific to the oyster. Oysters are delicate. They're mostly water held together by very fragile protein structures. When you retort sterilize them, the proteins contract, the water gets driven out, and the oyster shrinks and toughens. What you get is a small, rubbery nugget sitting in oil, with the texture of a pencil eraser that's been left in the sun.
The flavor is still there, which is somehow worse. Because the flavor says oyster, and the texture says industrial gasket, your brain receives two contradictory signals, and resolves them by making you want to spit it out.
The oil is doing work too. The oil is supposed to preserve the texture, keep things moist. But in a retort can, the oil gets hot enough to essentially confit the oyster, and then the oyster sits in that oil for months. The result is dense, chewy, and intensely fishy in a way that fresh oysters are not. It's the difference between a fresh grape and a raisin, except the raisin is made of mollusk.
Position 7. Canned Vienna sausages. The meat that's become a punchline. Small, pale, cylindrical. They sit in a thin broth that's technically a liquid, but behaves more like a suggestion.
The food science term for what Vienna sausages are is an emulsion gel. That's what happens when you take mechanically separated meat, add fat, water, salt, and phosphate binders, and then cook the whole thing under pressure until it forms a stable, uniform matrix. The texture is consistent all the way through. No grain, no fiber, no variation. It's meat that's been homogenized into a state of perfect, featureless smoothness.
Which is exactly what makes it so unsettling. Your brain expects meat to have texture. It expects to bite through fibers, to feel some resistance. Vienna sausages offer no resistance. They yield instantly, like a very firm pudding that's been shaped into a sausage. The flavor is mostly salt and a vague generic meatiness that could be pork, chicken, or possibly a laboratory's best guess.
And yet they're a survival food. High fat, high salt, calorie dense, shelf stable for years. They were originally designed as a shelf stable meat product for people who didn't have refrigeration, and they've been doing that job since the late 1800s. The problem isn't that they fail at being food. The problem is that they succeed at being food in a way that makes you question what food means.
Position 6. Canned whole chicken. This is a real product. A full chicken stuffed into a can, pressure cooked until the bones soften. You can buy this, it exists. It's sold primarily as a survival ration, and the USDA lists it as a legitimate emergency food.
The visual is the entire problem. When you open the can, you're looking at a whole bird, beak and all, compressed into a cylinder. The pressure cooking has broken down the collagen in the bones until they're soft enough to eat, which means the structural integrity of the chicken is gone. The bird has the shape of a chicken, but the firmness of a wet paper bag.
And then it collapses. That's the detail that gets me. You open the can, and the chicken, which has been holding the shape of the can for months, just slumps. It doesn't slice, it doesn't carve, it slumps. You eat it with a spoon.
From a survival standpoint, it's practical. Complete protein and the softened bones provide calcium, which is actually a real consideration in a long-term emergency. You're getting nutrients that most survival foods don't provide. The problem is entirely psychological. Humans have a very strong response to the visual of a whole animal that's been cooked until it can't hold itself up.
The gap between label and content here's minimal, which is almost worse. The label says whole chicken. The can contains a whole chicken. Nobody is being deceived, and yet the experience of opening it's universally described as horrifying.
Position 5. Canned fish assholes. And I want to be very clear that this is the actual product. The anal sphincters of tuna fish, cleaned, canned, and sold. Sometimes marketed as tuna delizia, which is an Italian word that means delight, and I'm going to let that sit there.
Tuna delizia. The delight is a can of fish anises. The texture is described as chewy, and the flavor as intensely fishy, which is exactly what you'd expect from a product that's literally a can of sphincters.
This is a real commercial product, primarily sold in parts of Asia, and available as a curiosity item online. It isn't a joke product. People eat this. It's considered a delicacy in some regions, which is a reminder that delicacy is a cultural construct, and some cultures have constructed their delicacies out of the wrong end of the fish.
The canning process doesn't improve it. Pressure cooking a sphincter doesn't transform it into something else. It just makes the sphincter hot and shelf-stable. What emerges from the can is a pile of small, pale, ring-shaped pieces of tissue, packed in brine, with a texture that's being compared to rubber bands soaked in fish stock.
And here's the thing about the science. These fail because of what pressure processing does to collagen. Collagen is the structural protein in connective tissue. When you heat it under pressure, it breaks down into gelatin. That's why slow-cooked meat becomes tender. But sphincters are almost entirely smooth muscle and connective tissue. There isn't much collagen to break down. What you get instead is a dense, elastic texture that resists chewing and then releases a concentrated hit of fish flavor.
So the can becomes a reactor vessel. You aren't preserving the food. You're cooking it into a different, often worse, form of itself. The Maillard reactions that make roasted meat taste good don't happen in a sealed can the same way. Instead, you get the breakdown products of proteins and fats that have been held at high temperature for a long time. Sulfur compounds, bitter peptides, the whole spectrum of things that make food taste old.
And that's the misconception that runs through this entire list. Canned food isn't preserved in its original state. It's cooked at 240 to 250 degrees under pressure. That fundamentally transforms its chemistry and texture. You aren't eating preserved fresh food. You're eating a pressure-cooked version of it. Sometimes that's fine. Peaches survive. Beans survive. A whole chicken doesn't survive. Sphincter doesn't survive.
Now we move into the truly cursed tier. The canned foods that aren't just unappetizing, but actively dangerous or existentially disturbing.
Position 4. Canned surströmming. Swedish fermented herring. The most notorious canned food on the planet, and for good reason.
The process starts innocently enough. Herring, caught in the Baltic, fermented in barrels with just enough salt to prevent rotting, but not enough to stop fermentation. The lactic acid bacteria do their work, breaking down proteins and producing a cocktail of compounds that includes hydrogen sulfide, which is rotten eggs, butyric acid, which is vomit, and ammonia. Then the herring is canned, and here's the critical detail. The fermentation doesn't stop.
The can is under constant pressure from the ongoing fermentation. The cans actually bulge. And a bulging can is normally the universal sign of botulism, of food that will kill you. But with surströmming, the bulge is the point. It means the fermentation is working. It's the only food where the danger sign is also the quality sign.
When you open a can of surströmming, the contents spray pressurized brine and gas. This isn't a metaphor. The can is a pressure vessel. The standard advice is to open it outdoors, underwater, or with a gas mask. The smell is so potent that multiple airlines have banned it from flights. Not just because of the smell, though that would be enough. Because a pressurized can of Sostreaming that ruptures in a cargo hold at altitude can spray fermented brine across a radius of several meters, and the brine is corrosive enough to damage aircraft wiring.
That's the misconception that matters here. The worst canned foods aren't the ones that taste bad. They're the ones that are dangerous. Sostreaming is a genuine hazard. A can that's been sitting in a warm pantry for a year is a small bomb filled with fermented fish and acid.
And yet people eat it. It's a traditional Swedish dish, eaten with flatbread, potatoes, onions, and sour cream. The flavor, for those who have acquired the taste, is described as intensely savory, funky, complex. The smell is the barrier, and the smell is one of the most powerful food odors ever documented.
The chemistry is fascinating. The lactic acid bacteria produce the same compounds that make aged cheese and fermented sausage taste good, but in concentrations and combinations that tip over into something that reads as decay rather than fermentation. The hydrogen sulfide gives the rotten egg note. The butyric acid gives the vomit note. The ammonia gives the sharp, eye-watering note. Together, they form an odor that is, and I'm being generous here, memorable.
Position 3. Canned balut. For the uninitiated, balut is a fertilized duck egg with a developed embryo, boiled and eaten in the shell. It's a common street food in the Philippines and parts of Southeast Asia. It is, for many people, the single most challenging food on the planet.
The canned version takes this and makes it worse. You get a pressure-cooked duck embryo in warm broth. The visual is unmistakably a bird fetus. The texture is described as cartilage-like. The broth has absorbed the flavor of the embryo, which is to say, it tastes like a very concentrated duck.
Balut is already a food that requires cultural context to appreciate. The people who love it, love it. They describe the broth, the yolk, the tiny bones. But the canning process doesn't preserve any of the nuance. It pressure cooks the embryo until the bones are soft, the feathers are indistinguishable from the skin, and the whole thing becomes a uniform gray-brown mass in a tin.
The psychological barrier is immense. Humans have a very strong response to the visual of a developed embryo. We're hardwired to recognize baby animals, and balut triggers that recognition in a way that most foods do not. Adding the canning process, which flattens and homogenizes the visual, doesn't help. It just makes it look like a baby bird that's been through an industrial process.
Position 2. Canned spam. And I know this one is controversial because spam is beloved. It sells millions of cans annually. It's a cultural staple in Hawaii, Guam, and the Philippines. It has a museum. It has a festival. It's been the subject of serious academic study.
But the ingredient list is the thing. Pork with ham, salt, water, modified potato starch, sugar, and sodium nitrite. That's it. That's the entire recipe. And the process is what food scientists call sectioned and formed. The meat is emulsified, mixed into a fine paste, and then cooked in the can. That's what gives spam its signature uniform texture. There's no grain, no fiber, no variation. It's a solid block of meat emulsion.
When you open a can of spam, it slides out in one piece, holding the shape of the can with a layer of gelatin on the outside. The gelatin is the meat's own collagen, rendered out during cooking and then set. It is, objectively, a little gross. The texture when cold is firm and slightly springy. The flavor is very salty, very savory, and entirely uniform.
The paradox is that spam is both unappetizing and beloved. It's the definitive example of a food that's objectively strange but culturally redeemed. In Hawaii, spam musubi is a genuine delicacy. In the Philippines, spam is a breakfast staple. In Guam, per capita spam consumption is among the highest in the world. The same product that looks like a pink brick when it comes out of the can is also a comfort food for millions of people.
The survival angle is real too. Spam is calorie dense, high in fat and salt, and shelf stable for years. It was a wartime ration for a reason. It kept soldiers alive. The sodium nitrite is a preservative, and also gives the meat its pink color. Without it, the meat would be gray. That pink color is doing a lot of psychological work.
And now position 1. The bottom of the barrel. The worst canned food ever invented. and I want to be clear that this is a contested title because there are so many contenders. But for our criteria, the winner is canned head cheese, also known as brawn.
Head cheese is a terrine made from the meat of a pig's head, set in aspic. The aspic is the gelatin that renders out of the bones and connective tissue. When it's made fresh, it can be quite good. It's a traditional charcuterie item. It has texture, flavor, a certain rustic charm.
The canned version is a gray, wobbly block with visible snout pieces. When you open it, the gelatin has separated. There's a layer of liquid on top, and the block itself has the consistency of a very firm jelly that's been left in the sun. The snout pieces are visible, which is a problem because snout is one of those foods that people prefer not to look at directly.
The flavor is porky, which is fine, but the texture is the killer. The aspic, which is supposed to be delicate and melt in the mouth, has been retort sterilized until it's rubbery. The meat pieces are soft and slightly grainy. The whole thing wobbles when you touch it. It's the texture of a food that's given up on being food.
And here's the thing about the nuclear bunker verdict. The honest answer is that the most unappetizing canned foods are often the most nutritionally dense. The canning process that destroys texture preserves nutrients. Head cheese is calorie dense, high in protein and fat. Surströmming is high in protein and omega-3 fatty acids, fermented so it's shelf stable. Canned whole chicken is complete protein with bioavailable calcium. These aren't bad survival foods. They're excellent survival foods that happen to be psychologically devastating.
The trade-off between palatability and survival is real. There's a concept in emergency preparedness called appetite fatigue. It's the documented phenomenon where people in survival situations stop eating, even when food is available, because the food is so monotonous or unappealing that they'd rather go hungry. It isn't a punchline. It's a genuine problem. Aid workers have documented it in refugee camps. Military researchers have studied it in field rations.
And that's the thing about day 40 in the bunker. The question isn't whether surströmming would keep you alive. It would. The question is whether you'd eat it. And the answer, for a significant number of people, is no. Not because they're being dramatic, because the psychological barrier is real. The smell, the texture, the visual. Your body says no before your brain gets a vote.
So which of these would actually save you? The honest answer is spam and canned whole chicken. Spam because it's calorie dense, palatable enough, and culturally normalized. Canned whole chicken because it's nutritionally complete and the bones provide calcium. The rest are either too psychologically challenging or too dangerous to rely on.
Surströmming is nutritionally viable, but the psychological toll might outweigh the caloric benefit. Canned lutefisk and canned haggis are edible but not appealing enough to sustain you through appetite fatigue. Canned Vienna sausages are fine in small doses, but the texture fatigue sets in fast. Canned fish assholes are, and I can't believe I'm saying this, a legitimate protein source, but the name is the problem. You can't eat something called fish assholes for 40 days and maintain the will to live.
And that's the real conclusion. The worst tin on the list isn't the same as the least useful tin. Head cheese is the most unappetizing thing we found, but it'd keep you alive. The least useful is probably canned lutefisk, because it's mostly water, low in calories, and the texture is so off-putting that even starving people might refuse it.
There's something honest about a food that tells you up front it's going to be terrible. Canned head cheese doesn't pretend. It looks exactly like what it is. Surströmming announces itself from across the room. These are foods that have no marketing problem, because no amount of marketing could help.
Speaking of cans that bulge, I want to bring in Hilbert, because he's been sitting at the desk this entire time, and I have a feeling he has thoughts.
The word you keep using is bulge. That isn't the right word. In the trade, we called it swell. Hydrogen swell. And a can with hydrogen swell isn't the same thing as a can that's merely revolting. One of those is a food problem. The other is a pressure vessel problem.
That's a distinction worth making. A can that's bulging because of botulism is a medical emergency. A can that's bulging because of fermentation is a chemistry problem.
I worked for 3 months in 98 as a quality control inspector at a canning facility in Gothenburg, surströmming line. My job was to check the cans before they went out. And the thing about surströmming is that the bulge is the feature. The fermentation is still going. That's what makes it surströmming. If the can isn't bulging, the batch failed.
How do you tell a good bulge from a bad bulge?
You listen. A good can of surströmming has a specific hiss when you open it. The experienced consumers, they can tell the quality by the sound. Too much hiss, the fermentation went too far. Not enough, it didn't go far enough. The gas pressure is the quality indicator. We had a man, Lars, who could grade a batch by tapping the cans with a pencil. He had been doing it for 30 years. He was never wrong.
What happened with the batch you refused to sign off on?
The cans were too bulged. I said the batch was over-fermented. My supervisor told me the bulge was a feature, not a bug. I said a feature is something the customer wants. Nobody wants a can that explodes when you look at it. He said that's what makes it authentic. I said authentic is a word people use when they're selling you something terrible. He fired me.
The airline ban. You said it wasn't just about the smell.
No. The smell is bad, but the smell isn't going to bring down a plane. The pressure is the problem. A can of surströmming in a cargo hold at altitude, the pressure differential can rupture the can. And then you've fermented brine spraying across the hold. The brine is corrosive. It'll eat through wiring insulation. There was an incident, a cargo hold full of surströmming cans, and the cleanup cost more than the entire shipment. After that, the airlines just banned it.
That's the detail that most coverage misses. The smell is the headline, but the danger is the pressure. A pressurized can of fermented fish is a small bomb with a fishy payload.
I still have a can from that batch, the one I refused to sign off on. It's in my pantry. It's been there since 98. It's probably still perfectly edible. Or it's a biohazard. I've never been brave enough to open it.
You've kept a can of surströmming for 28 years as a professional memento.
It's a reminder. Some things aren't supposed to be in a can. I could bring it to the studio. We could open it. For science.
Ningguan?
Absolutely not.
The offer stands.
That's the list. 10 down to 1. Canned lutefisk, canned haggis, canned smoked oysters, canned Vienna sausages, canned whole chicken, canned fish assholes, canned surströmming, canned balut, canned spam, and canned head cheese. And the question that actually matters, the one Daniel buried in the middle of the prompt, is this. If the apocalypse comes and you're in a bunker with nothing but surströmming and canned whole chicken, do you eat, or do you accept the alternative?
The answer is that you eat the chicken first, because it's nutritionally complete and the visual is survivable. And then, when the chicken runs out, you open the surströmming and you discover that appetite fatigue isn't a metaphor, it's a wall. And some people will climb it, and some people will not.
The era of the cursed can maybe ending. Freeze-drying, retort pouches, irradiated foods. The technology is moving away from the sealed metal cylinder. But there's something honest about a can of head cheese. It tells you the truth. It's a gray, wobbly block with visible snout pieces, and it's never pretended to be anything else.
If you have a canned food horror story, or if you've actually eaten surströmming and lived to tell the tale, write in. We might do a follow-up. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the cans from exploding.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.